immunogenic drivers of variants which actually drove papillomaviruses, you selected against the most common oncogene. And so this was satisfying that you had complementation and then you had inhibition of signaling of an oncogene. And this was about nearly 15 years ago. And at that time, we probably, in hindsight, maybe should have thought about RAS. And, you know, we probably had an inhibitor of a RAS process, but we didn't follow it up because we were so obsessed with the Notch pathway. We actually, in many ways, got the Notch field going with these two papers that we published in 2001 with Annapurni Rangarajan as a graduate student who is now a faculty member in IISc. And let me tell you a little bit about these papers. So one was this whole idea that activated Notch complements papillomaviruses and phenocopies through the activation of RAS pathways. And the other was a differentiation story. And so a lot of the field got very confused because we published this paper with Anu in a sort of global collaboration showing that Notch actually is a regulator of differentiation in the epidermis in skin. And you actually need to decrease Notch activity to get skin differentiation. The guys in the oncogenic field then argued that what you really need then is the loss of function of Notch. And the gain of function of Notch is not important. What you need is the loss of function of Notch. And mutations, I mean, cancer biologists are so obsessed with mutations that they found a few mutations, for example, in head and neck cancers, and this was a Science paper. Exome sequencing of head and neck squamous cell carcinoma reveals inactivating mutations in Notch. And there were something like four mutations or something, and they made it to the Notch paper, to Science, with the argument that loss of function Notch is what it is. A cancer research paper, which is not so high profile, looking at several hundred papers, actually showed that it's a very small subset that you actually get Notch mutations. But if you actually look at the pathway in terms of what is expressed, all the Notch components are hugely expressed, and you have copy number of the receptor as well, downstream pathway of the activation. And this brings me to a very important model. So investments in genomic sequencing and global investments in genomic sequencing, which have been incredibly important in the last 15, 20 years in driving the human genome and cancer genome project, showed no mutations of any kind which are in the cervical cancers. So you see a whole spectrum of mutations, virtually no RAS mutations. You do see some mutations in PI3 kinase and some other mutations, and I'll come to this FBW7 mutation later, but you don't actually get oncogenic driver mutations. So you get a mutational landscape in cancers, but you can't actually pin down what they are. And if you look at this TCGA project, and some of my colleagues recently now mined the whole TCGA project, and you get all the pathway components of the Notch pathway upregulated. The Notch1 genes, HES1, and please note the HES1, I'll come to this a little bit later. All the Notch ligands, they're hugely upregulated. But not only are they all upregulated, you get copy number amplifications of all the positive regulators of Notch signaling, you get inactivation of the negative regulators of Notch signaling. And so what we found is that our original assumption was that the Notch pathway is activated would have been based on the idea that the Notch pathway itself is the Notch gene itself is genetically activated, right? So either something is happening, which you get again a function of in the Notch gene, or you get a very specific. But what actually happens is a pathway stabilization. And so if you look at HES1, which is one of the downstream, it's a key downstream transcriptional factor of the Notch pathway, and this is some amazing data that we've just noticed by mining. You can categorize human cancers into two varieties. Human cancers which have HES1 amplification, and human cancers which don't have HES1 amplification. And if you look at cervical cancers falls in the category of HES1 amplification. As I just told you, the head and neck cancers fall into HES1 amplifications, and there are a whole range of cancers which have no HES1 amplification. What is interesting is that nearly 15 years ago, Murthy's lab in Sloan Kettering published this paper, which is that if you look at chromosomal amplifications in cervical cancers, 3q gain and deletions of 2q30, and 3q gain is where HES1 is. So HES1 is on the 3q arm. So I think you have to rethink a little bit the way you think of cancers. I mean, you think of cancers typically as a bundle of mutations of either gain of function or loss of function. I think they're very important. But probably there's a whole amount of mutations which are actually compensatory mutations of various kinds. And it's the stabilization of the output which happens at the end which really matters. And so it's a sort of, it's a mixture of both chromosomal events and tumors which you have to think about at the end of the day in terms of cancers. Why has the cancer field been reluctant to absorb this? The reluctance actually comes from a very old and a very important study. So this is the Philadelphia chromosome. So the most important translocation in cancer, or the most well-known translocation in cancer, is actually the Philadelphia chromosome, which is a 14 to 22 chromosome translocation. And if you talk to my hematology colleagues, they'll tell you how the Abelson tyrosine kinase, which is identified, has now converted chronic myeloid leukemia into an outpatient disease. So chronic myeloid leukemia 20, 30 years ago was actually quite a lethal disease. But now, if you talk to the hematologists, they treat them in the OPD because of the discovery of drugs against the chromosome, against the Philadelphia chromosome. This is a single translocation which occurs in nearly 80 to 90% of chronic myeloid leukemia. There has been no cancer, to the best of my knowledge, where you get a single chromosomal translocation of that extent. So this 80 to 90% translocations that you get, to the best of my knowledge, there's not a single cancer where you get that. So you're actually left with a situation, and I'll come back to that, you're actually left with a situation where you get 15%, 20% of something like HES1, and you get a heterogeneity which stabilizes pathways. So you will get an output like the Notch pathway complementation, but you won't get it by a single translocation. You'll get 15%, 20% of this, 10% of this, and so on. So I think we have to now use a combination of histopathology and systems biology approaches to relook at these cancers and classify them in a way by which we tend to think of them as an output of a product of a pathway with maybe heterogeneity built into the system. And you may not have a single event which is 90% of some kind, right? So that's an important take-home message from this. And I think the global efforts with the sort of genomic sequencings was the right thing to do, but it has given us lessons which are somewhat different from what we had thought of in the original instance. Okay. Here is a very interesting paper which came out in Nature from a Japanese group on esophageal cancers. So they actually didn't put it in the title, but they show that the predominant mutations in esophageal cancers are in the Notch1 pathway. What is interesting is that they actually report these mutations in a paper which came earlier this year, but they didn't even classify whether they were gain of function or loss of function. So we have no idea what these mutations actually do. But you go back into the slide which I showed you a little earlier, and esophageal cancers is the cancer which has one of the highest HES1 amplification. So we have a situation where you have a key pathway amplification remain. Do the lineages change? If you have a virus in America, does it remain in the American system? If you have a virus which evolves in India, how does that evolve and so on? And so we set up, and believe me, this is not such a trivial matter. So the polio virus, for example, which all of us are so comfortable and we think of it as a settled issue, this is science, this is a commentary in Science last week about hard choices as the endgame strategy falters because the polio virus has switched, okay? And we are no longer in the situation now where you can say a polio virus has switched in some corner of Africa, it's not going to matter here. Globalization has essentially meant that from 25 million travelers in the 50s, we're now at 1 billion travelers, right? So viruses spread. I mean, when you have diseases now, they come from various parts, they spread very quickly, and even if you're not concerned about what happens in Africa, believe me, these are choices that you will soon be faced with here. And so it's important to know what happens out there in this. So Narayan Murthy visited us a few years ago, and he said, look, I'd like to fund a dengue vaccine project. And Chitra had at that point sequenced the dengue genome, and we said, look, we'll come to vaccine constructs in a while, but right now what we'd like to do is two things. We'd like to sequence viruses in this country on scale using metagenomic approaches to try and see what is the distribution of dengue across the country, and we've been collaborating with Dr. Jayanti Shastri and others all over the country in a large-scale dengue sequencing program, and we'll set up a similar program in Africa. And this is very interesting. I'm sort of running out of time, so we've now modeled with bioinformatics colleagues, Sadamani's group and others. And this is a very interesting study because this is a study being led by Rahul Roy and IISC, Ramakrishna Prasad, who's an infectious disease physician, Sadamani, who's a computational and structural biologist, and Meenakshi, who's a PhD student from her lab. And so we've developed now pipelines by which you can model viruses from the sequencing. We now have some dengue constructs by which we think that the interesting thing would be to make a dengue vaccine which works across serotypes, and I'd be happy to share how we're going about it. But what I want to talk about is a little bit this Africa program. So if you look at models of infectious disease predictions and look at what and where the infectious diseases might strike, there are two red zones. The red zones are in India, and the red zones are in Africa. So this again brings me back to the point that we like to think of us as the top three global economies and that sort of thing, but the reality is actually this. And here is a fact. If you were to take one single fact which would be useful for you in your policy and other conversations, every single pathogen which has moved of importance in the last 30, 40 years has been a zoonotic break. And a zoonotic break is essentially means that it has moved from a non-human source into a human, right? So whether you look at HIV, whether you look at influenza, whether you look at Nipah, whether you look at Ebola, which has moved from bats, every single one of them, including SARS, has moved from zoonotic sources to humans. So if you're going to think of health systems, if you're going to think of epidemic preparedness, if you're going to have systems in place, your traditional ideas of vets and doctors and labs has to be rethought. Because all the public health challenges, and this has costed billions, if money is what matters to you, this has costed billions in terms of HIV and other kinds of diseases. So you have to now start thinking of training programs, you've got to start thinking of teamwork and a whole range of systems which can actually take this into account. So the Global Virome Project is actually a very interesting project, and it fits into some of the sequencing strategies we have. So the question that the Global Virome guys asked is, can we predict the next pathogens? Okay. So if we were to develop strategies in which we went and sequenced from zoonotic sources, would we then have the computational power to be able to actually predict what might happen? And I would encourage you to start reading and thinking about this. This is a very interesting project which grew out of UC Davis and is now in many parts of the world. The Chinese have just put in a billion sequencing zoonotic hotspots with the idea to see whether they can pick up the next pathogens. And you please look up this project. So when we were discussing with Narayan Murthy that we'd also like to do the similar kinds of projects in ICMR called us for a meeting, and they said we would like to support an Indo-Africa program, and they've put us in touch with a number of people. It's actually being funded by Narayan Murthy and not ICMR right now. And what we have now is a sequencing program which we do in Nairobi, the Kavi Center for Clinical Sciences, where we sequence pathogens. Why do I say pathogens and not dengue? Because detail, everything finally, the devil is in the detail. We landed in Nairobi and we said, can we start sequencing dengue? And they said, no, but the bulk of the dengue is in Mombasa. So Mombasa is a 1,000-year-old Arab city. This is a 15th century painting of Mombasa by a Portuguese. The bulk of dengue is in Mombasa, and the logistics of getting samples for us, we're just flown all the way to Nairobi and set up this sequencing lab. The logistics is pretty complicated, so why don't we start sequencing what we have? And we said, what do you have? They said, we have a lot of drug-resistant Neisseria, which is a very important problem here, gonococci. Why don't you sequence those? It's one of those funny situations where the dengue genome is about 10 kb. Bacterial genome is actually very large, in the order of several million. And we said, sure, we'll do that. And so we've set up a sequencing lab in Nairobi, where we've been sequencing, and we have now set up capacity for actually sequencing very large bugs. But what is really very nice is that this is a genuinely Indo-African team. So this is people from the NCBS community and the locals in Nairobi. And that was very important for us because Dr. Jayanthi Shastri was asking me about my African experience, and one of the things we found was that all their verticals were funded from the West, and that's changing now. The Delta's grant, which is the African Academy of Sciences grant, has actually completely said that, you know, it should be anchored there. And so I think the philosophy is changing, and that's going to make a huge difference to managing outbreaks and so on and so forth. So we are at the Kavi Center for Clinical Research, and It's at the Kenyatta Hospital in Nairobi, and I would encourage some of you to immerse yourself there. There's a lot of learning that can be done from learning about HIV and so on and how it's been managed. But what I want to come to is this point. So Margaret Chan, who's the Director General of the World Health Organization, gave a very interesting talk at Princeton a few years ago, which is online, on the Ebola crisis. And she made one point, which I think is very important. And that is, if you don't take a health system approach, you can do what you want in the lab, but it's not going to work. Because you have to work with communities like Dr. Shastri and others who work in the public health space. Because they know what happens, they understand transmission chains, they understand who's vulnerable, and that information is not just important. So it's not as if you do something in the lab and everything is downstream. It has to be a much more of a circle for you to be actually effective. And so the African Academy of Sciences has actually conceptualized this, and this is something that we still haven't started conceptualizing. We still think of our PhD programs as technical training of scientific quality, and the Africans are actually ahead of us. They're talking about research leadership, they're talking about scientific citizenship, they're talking about research management, culture, and infrastructure in their PhD and postdoc programs. And so those of you who are, you know, thinking about 21st century institutions in this country and, you know, the future of science and everything else, this is something that I think we need to think about. And the idea of scientific citizenship. You cannot have purely scientists. I think you need to have scientists who understand the whole spectrum from early on of policy, and this has to be done by immersions of various kinds, and this is what we're trying to do for a number of our younger colleagues at the Kavi Center. This is pretty much, I think, what we think we're working with her too in setting up this program. Just one last couple of lines. The Kemri Wellcome Trust, for example, in Nairobi is a meeting that we're attending next month. Actually, these are the themes that they have: epidemiology, clinical research, health research, and bioscience. And why do I bring this up? I bring this up because we do not have health systems and health-oriented institutions in this country. We have medical colleges, which are hugely challenged by the day-to-day needs. We have basic science institutions, but we don't have people who actually think of health systems. Like, for example, the Harvard Center for Global Health. We just don't have places like that who actually integrate various aspects of interdisciplinary research and build teams. And this is something that we really need to start thinking about. For example, if you look at, so can you guess approximately how many medical colleges there are in India? Just a number randomly.
1,000.
About 370 is the number that you get. How many of these are allopathic? So, okay, there are 370 allopathic medical colleges. How many Unani, Ayurvedic, and traditional medicine colleges are there? Just a number?
100.
370. So the number that is thrown out is 370 allopathic colleges, 370 traditional medical colleges. Try to get one person from this campus to talk to one person from these campuses. No way. They're both in parallel universes. You probably could get the Republicans and Democrats in the US to talk to each other, but you can't get these guys to talk to each other. But the reality of the health system is that 50% of your health system goes to allopathy, 50% goes to traditional medicine. We just don't recognize it. Because we make policy sitting somewhere in some institution where the ecosystem is literally selected by the people that you want to talk to or that you're comfortable to talk to. So if you're talking about health systems research, I think there has to be a parallel bottoms-up and top-down recognition of reality. We have to get people working across systems, you know, maybe joint degrees, immersions of various kinds. There has to be this because this is the reality. And so I think these are the kind of challenges that we need to start thinking about and if we're really going to take on the system. This is, you know, the Pandora Net who we're talking to, who have a sort of unit across Africa, and this pretty much, yeah. So finally, for those of you who are pure basic scientists, by the way, it's not, you don't have to approach this from a medical system. Shilaja, have you heard of DROS Africa? DROS Africa is a community, we're trying to get them over to the campus next month or whenever we can, is a community of researchers who do basic research in Africa with pretty much this idea that you need places like TIFR and versions of TIFR to form part of the ecosystem, to take on challenges of health systems and so on. You need the whole gamut, but you need them all talking to each other. So I think we've done okay on time. So I'll stop there and happy to take questions and let's have it as a discussion for a few minutes or whatever.
Sure. lambdas, but also the way we are coming up and also talking about the future health research systems where the concept of scientific citizenship and leadership and so on, these, the way you kind of augment things, particularly in the sphere of the viruses, cancer research, etc. It's a very interesting talk. Thank you very much. So the talk is open for some questions and discussion. Yes.
No, she's asking with reference to dengue, I think.
In general, virus-related.
So this is what she does for a daily bread and butter.
You're actually
could you
very
yourself?
Right because
Dr. Jayanti, could you just tell them a little bit about what you do and who you are?
So I head the clinical microbiology department at Nair Hospital, and I also head the molecular public health laboratory of the Municipal Corporation of Mumbai. We receive samples for infectious disease molecular diagnosis from 4 tertiary care and 16 secondary care hospitals in Mumbai. So actually you are very right, viral diagnostics have improved in the last 10 years. And it is the mandate of the ICMR to start viral diagnostic centers across the state. In Mumbai itself, Municipal Corporation, in fact, in wake of the deluge in 2005, wanted to start a viral diagnosis. So we started it pretty early in 2007. However, the ICMR centers are functional in the last 5 years. Yes, of course. And we have, actually every day we are learning. Because what we used to think, could not be the diagnosis is actually the diagnosis. Like, I'll give you an example of scrub typhus. Now, we never ever thought that scrub typhus was so much in urban areas. But when we do these specific screening methods, we've started seeing a lot of scrub typhus cases. Yes, partly what you are saying is so true. Viral diagnosis has improved and reporting has improved. But reporting, at least in the Municipal Corporation of Bombay, private hospitals are not mandated to report. So what is really happening is dengue, yes, they are mandated to report. Pandemic influenza, they are reporting, but they're not reporting everything. So since we also know that 60% of the healthcare is done in the private sector, I feel there is gross underreporting. So whatever is shown is just a tip of the iceberg.
Biologically, do you think that biology,
I hand it over to Sudhir.
Yeah, right. So the people who've looked at, so that's our interest with dengue too, right, in terms of selection. So when people have looked at the Ebola sequencing, right, they've gone and sequenced bats to see how much, what happens when there's a shift. So what is scary is that if we are right, even single amino acid shifts can do the zoonotic shift. And, once it shifts, then, it's obviously susceptible to that. The challenge really is that you're dealing with something like Ebola, which is really life-threatening, right? So the focus tends to be on developing reagents and protocols and drugs to manage the epidemic. In a sense, what is the change from the bat to this becomes secondary. So that is the focus, and people do that. We just sent Jayanti, our full dengue, which I didn't show, the full sequencing study. We've got 3 or 4 insights which are emerging from our study, but still tentative. One is co-infection and disease severity. The second is the kind of lineage and clade shifts which are operating. So the question that we asked ourselves was, you have now several 100,000 cases. When you get dengue as an outbreak in Mumbai, so we've sequenced from Mumbai, from Delhi, from Jodhpur, and Bangalore. So when you get shifts. When you get distribution, for example, in THSTI, the pool that we get, you get only dengue 2. Is it because you're getting some travelers who are coming from elsewhere, or is this an endogenous shift? So from early data that we seem to be seeing, much of the lineage selection that we're seeing seems to be local. By local, I mean India. The question that we asked ourselves was, India is such a large country, so when you're getting outbreaks, are they coming from, you know, one metro to the other, or is it coming from somewhere else? And we're also looking at the point, single point mutations that are emerging. So we can tell you the single point mutations in the antibody sites which are vaccine relevant. Are they the drivers of the shift? I mean, I don't have a way yet to tell you that. But the three or four kinds of data that we have is single point variants in relevant regions, clade and lineage analysis in various regions. That's the kind of thing. But our focus was actually on sequencing using very small amounts of serum. I mean, that was the sort of, So I don't want to overstate what we've done.
What came from Mexico, there were, you know, virus strains from three sources. It was the big one, so it was a swine strain, the avian strain, human strain, and the pig was like a mixed, the vessel, you know, where the mixing of the viruses used to take place. So that's how a novel strain came up. Yes, of course, biology is contributing to the change in the virus. And the rapidity with which it's changing every year. Now this year, if you see the Western reports, the flu shot is not good enough for the current strain of the virus. So every year it is evolving, but of course the shift had happened and there was this novel strain.
So given that there are instances of viruses coming from animals to humans, how does one plan for it? Because there's one thing which is it has happened and then you take care of it. But what are the precursors to this? Are there precursors? Yeah. How do you plan for it as a health?
So the Global Virome Project, which is not liked by everybody, argues that if you build databases of sequences and then you at least, you know, you have some way of knowing what is out there. But the numbers that they throw at you are huge. There are critics who say that this is a very difficult exercise, you know, identifying pre-existing viruses out there and then being prepared for them through computation and other tools is a mug's game, because there's no way that we can actually predict what's going to happen, and that we should just build a lot of capacity on the ground to deal with it when it happens, you know, more of the kind of what we're doing. This is completely, I mean, you're asking a question which there is no answer to right now in one way. I mean,
but
yeah.
There must be some thought process, right?
These are the thought processes. The thought processes are essentially, one is that do this massive sequencing and identify what is out there and make a prediction and be prepared for it. The other is just keep improving health systems hugely, and so when it happens, we can deal with it.
Naturally adapted to those animal cells, right? What really is changing that they are adapting to the human cells in certain infections?
So the people who believe single point mutations would argue that single point variance is what drives it. But I mean, that cannot. We've known enough of biology, and you know, pretty much of what we've done for 25 years of cancer biology, that in biology you rarely get one thing, right? I mean, anybody who believes that one thing is the answer invariably fails.
It was very impressive effort in reaching out also to Africa, and I can sense that you are saying there are things to learn from there that we should do here.
Hugely.
But it's not so obvious, because what we could do in this country, you do have medical colleges turning out doctors, you do have also private practitioners. It seems like on one end you are saying that information is not gathered and collected, and that might help us. That seems like a solvable problem if we incentivize the primary physicians into reporting things that are out. chunk of what you want to do. It seems like you want something between the medical college and, let's say, TIFR or NCBS, something in between that, some institute which will do something. I couldn't get that exactly what.
So for example, if you look at the question of epidemic preparedness, the question that I was, the previous question just now. So the Harvard Global Health has, for example, a 40-page report, right, on their views on how epidemic preparedness should be done, right? And it's a substantial document which I've downloaded, which, and I'm happy to share that with you. I was just sort of pulling out little bit vignettes from that. I think the argument is that you need to have policy all the way from undergraduate training, you know, you need numbers. And so this fragmentization and silos that we operate in, you know, your engineers, your doctor, you know, biology, you go and do, you know, doctors and you become engineers. But the medics, for example, need economists, they need computer scientists, they need physicists, they need bureaucrats, they need everybody. But by the time you specialize in a medical college and then you do your MD, which is in some super specialization, by the time you do your next level of super specialization, even your friends are only your super specialists. The reason why the US has done so well is because they do medicine after an undergraduate degree. And that gives you three things. It gives you diversity at the input point, right? It gives you the ability of friends whom you can recombine later on, right? And it gives you a sort of lifelong ability to think in more than one dimension. The reality is our people, our training programs are very unidimensional.
You're talking about the training and the spare criticism of training. But I'm talking about, I thought you meant also structures that are not there in India. That should be there.
Yeah, I mean,
institutions of some kind. So
can I
get
can
to
I,
yeah,
what
please,
kind of
please.
See, I'll tell you, I do exactly understand what you're asking. See, let me tell you, doctors are very poor researchers. Okay, even if you ask a doctor what is your research question, there will be just a handful of them who will be able to answer. So what basically ICMR, the previous Dr. Katoch, what he had done was, he had built partnerships between medical colleges and research institutes. Today the need of the hour is that. So what we have at our end done, we are in fact, see, both have strengths. We have the clinical cases. We have the questions. Why is dengue so severe now? I've been seeing dengue cases since 15 years. Why is it severe now? So we build partnerships with institutes like NCBS who can do all the high-end sequencing and give us some answers about the kind of virus that patient was infected with. At my level, I just do a diagnosis, like a molecular test. I know that it is dengue. Beyond that, I don't know the character of that, characterization of the virus I don't have. So that information I get from them. We collaborated in a chikungunya project with ICGB, where we were looking at the genetic mutation which is required for adaptability to another vector. So you know, this building partnerships is what is the need of the hour, and in fact, this will go a long way in answering number of questions which all
Yeah, but I mean, if I could add one thing, building partnerships, you have to think of it on scale also, right? I mean, I think the answer at some level is scale, and I don't know how to get to scale.
Today, the dengue information they have got, in fact, we have not characterized the virus across India. So the information which we have got through this project is that with states, so this is very important towards vaccine development.
So can I take a step back? So the thing that bothers me the most, and the reason why I got into health systems, I mean, started thinking about health system, is the issue of advocacy in this country. Okay. So the papilloma, so globally, cervical cancer in the West is almost non-existent because of screening programs, right? And then the vaccine has now been introduced in many places. We still have one of the highest burdens. And it's a conversation we were having over lunch. How do you advocate for poor women's screening, poor women's disease in this country, right? They have no advocates. Cervical cancer is thought of as a poor woman's disease. There's absolutely no advocacy. And so the challenge really is policy can only flow when there is some barrier that we overcome about this advocacy problem. And I don't know, I don't have the answer to that. We were, you know, the whole lunch conversation was about papillomavirus vaccination. So for example, would our systems allow us to vaccinate boys? Because now in the UK and in Australia, they're saying, let's just vaccinate boys and girls, because the boys are the transmitters of it, right? Though the girls are the ones who get the disease. But we have to be able to, as a society, start believing that, you know, we need to vaccinate boys to prevent girls getting papillomaviruses. I mean, in the West, it's a little easier because they're now getting a lot of oropharyngeal cancers, which are papillomavirus, which we don't still see many here. So we have to start taking ownership beyond our immediate cause. Dengue you can get funded because, you know, everybody gets dengue. So I don't have the answers to, you know, so, yeah, go ahead. No, not really, because hepatitis, there's a huge amount of hepatitis in this country, which is, and what happened with HIV, just as the time when we got going on people realizing that we must take on hepatitis, HIV became the order of the day, and the hepatitis, there's a huge amount of hepatitis, which is completely ignored. If I can take 5 minutes, let me give you the kind of challenges that we have and why we must not race to the bottom. So one of the things we tell our companies and so on is manufacture hepatitis vaccines at the lowest cost. But you manufacture it at the lowest cost, there's no taker for it, right? Because these guys have to, you know, so we also have to start, you know, on one end we say that we're a rising economy. But now we're a rising economy which must give everything free or the cheapest, it's not going to work.
But hepatitis is part of the national immunization.
Now.
Since almost 10 years.
Yeah, but the challenge in that, if you talk to the people who make hepatitis, is they could get nobody to pay for it. So we have to start building examples where we are willing to invest and not have everything cheap. So we are the biggest manufacturers of vaccines in the low-end space, okay? You know, Serum Institute and others, we manufacture low-end vaccines for Africa and Asia and so on and so forth. We don't manufacture vaccines which are expensive. And so some counterintuitive things have to emerge where, you know, we start becoming a hub for, it's a bit like the IT industry, I think, at least. I mean, 10 years ago was basically aiming for the, you know, the lowest rung, which has done things for it. But so some of our policies have to now change in terms of the way we approach this.
Okay, so yeah. Maybe with that, maybe we'll put more discussion.
Sorry, I don't have the answers,
no.
But yeah.
So, thanks to Sudhir for this nice talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, we'll have a cup of tea at the
restaurant. You can have an action replay.
Oh. Okay. So let me just take this off.
Is it in Malayas? These are pictures normally clicked by the app for family members. And then we kind of played there, and we were solving through.
Thank you.
Sorry, sir. Yeah, I think you have to see that.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just put that in my mind.